From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. President Biden signs three executive orders today aimed at reversing some of former President Trump's hardline immigration policies. The orders seek to restore the asylum system, review changes made to legal immigration, and reunite migrant children separated from their parents under Trump's zero-tolerance policy for illegal border crossings. NPR's Joel Rose is with us. He covers immigration. And Joel, it's been 3 years since some of these families were separated. How many migrant children are still separated from their parents? And what is Biden planning to do about it?
Well, that number is certainly in the hundreds, but no one knows for certain. Activists do know that more than 1,000 parents were deported back to their home countries without their children. And immigration lawyers say more than 600 parents still cannot be located. On a call with reporters last night, a senior Biden administration official called it a, quote, moral failure and national shame, unquote, that the Trump administration separated families in order to discourage other migrants from coming to the border. The Biden administration is appointing a task force to identify these families that are still separated and also to make recommendations about how to reunify them and ensure that this cannot happen again.
So doing the reunification is hard. And then what comes next, Joel, is also fraught because, as you say, some of these children have been in the U.S. while their parents are in other countries. So would reunified families be given some kind of legal status?
That's a really good question. It is not one that the administration is expected to answer right away. For context, many of these parents have been deported back to Central America and are afraid to be reunified there because of security concerns, in many cases the same kind of concerns that led them to flee in the first place. So immigrant advocates are pushing the Biden administration to grant them some kind of legal status so that they can reunify here in the U.S. Biden administration officials, were asked about that last night, but they did not give a clear answer either way. They said that the remedies would depend on the individual situation of each separated family.
All right. And then there's the asylum-seeking process. On his first day in office, President Biden suspended what President Trump had called the Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers who used to be able to wait here in the U.S. while their cases were heard in immigration courts. So is Biden now proposing immediate changes to that policy, Joel?
Well, as you say, they have already suspended new enrollments into the Remain in Mexico program. But the big question now is what to do about the more than 68,000 migrants who were sent back to Mexico to wait outside the U.S. for their day in U.S. immigration courts. And the executive order will direct DHS to review the Remain in Mexico program, presumably to answer that question. Biden administration officials say that this policy has been a, quote, disaster from the start and has led to a humanitarian crisis in northern Mexico, unquote. But they also say it's going to take time to undo. They say that the situation at the border will not transform overnight. A senior official on a call with reporters yesterday said the people in the program will get some consideration because they've been waiting a very long time in terrible conditions. But the administration committed to putting a new system in place as quickly as they can. But we just don't know how long that's actually going to be.
I see. So then the third executive order today is going to kick off a review of several legal immigration policies. One of the big ones is the so-called public charge rule. Could you explain that, Joel? And is the rule going away now?
Sure. So the public charge rule makes it harder for immigrants to get green cards if they've used any of a long list of public benefits, things like food stamps, subsidized health insurance. And the rule has also made it possible for immigration officials to consider things like income and wealth when deciding who gets a green card. And immigrant advocates call that a wealth test. They've challenged it in court. And to answer your question, yes, it is likely going away. It is just a question of when. But this is just one of literally hundreds of changes that the Trump administration has made to federal regulations, changes that are small and large, and that have made it harder for immigrants to get green cards and other benefits. The Biden administration says it's also looking to identify and reverse those changes and to streamline the naturalization process, to make it easier, essentially, for millions of immigrants to become citizens.
And today's trio of executive actions is really just the start because President Biden has also proposed a much more sweeping immigration reform package that includes an 8-year path to citizenship for undocumented people in this country. Joel, does that have any chance in Congress this year? And how much political capital is the president willing to spend on it?
Those are good questions. It is hard to see the full bill getting through Congress, particularly the Senate, where Democrats have a razor-thin majority. But the Biden administration has been hinting that it would be willing to break apart the bill in hopes that some bite-sized pieces might have a better chance of getting passage. You know, that list might include protections for DACA recipients, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This is the program that protects immigrants who are brought to the country illegally as young children from deportation. That's a popular program that might be able to draw bipartisan support even in these polarized times.
Sure. And as you mentioned, DACA, the president also signed an order on his first day preserving and fortifying the program, as he put it. But there is a lawsuit in Texas challenging its legality. So there's still more to come on that front. Joel Rose covers immigration for NPR. Thanks, Joel.
You're welcome.
And if you include all those immigration orders, President Biden has already signed more than 40 executive actions since his term began. And he's also in the middle of intense negotiations to get another round of COVID relief passed. Let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, always good to speak with you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So the White House really is fast at work. What's your impression so far?
Well, they've moved forward with a series of executive orders on issues like immigration. They have a workable plan that they're developing on the vaccine and containment. And the level of rhetorical toxicity from the Oval Office has plummeted from about 100 to zero. So that's all progress. But they're still facing the major crisis. And I think ultimately we'll measure how they're doing in terms of can they implement the strong vaccine program? And can they get a robust stimulus through Congress? And the verdict is still out on how those happen.
Well, to that question, last night the president held his first Oval Office meeting with lawmakers, all Republicans, by the way, on coronavirus relief. And Biden's economic advisor, Jared Bernstein, told Morning Edition today that when it comes to that relief package, Biden is not willing to compromise as much as Republicans want. Let's listen.
I would say a pretty firm no to that in the following sense. If you think about what it costs to accomplish these policy goals, and you tote that up, you get to the kinds of numbers that we've been putting forth.
Julian, is the White House taking a lesson from the Obama administration 12 years ago when Obama scaled back his stimulus plan in the middle of an economic crisis to try to win Republican support, but then got very little in return?
Well, I think President Biden is torn. I think he remembers the lesson of 2009, that if you offer a smaller package and then compromise even further, you're still unlikely to get much Republican support. And he remembers that. But at the same time, this is a president who really strives to show that bipartisanship is possible despite all odds. And so I think Washington watchers are looking to see which way he moves as these negotiations unfold. But it sounds like he has his eye on a large stimulus passing.
The reason he seems to be such a fan of partnership in the Senate may be because he spent 36 years in the Senate. What do you think? Are there other presidents who come to mind who felt the same way and who were able to capitalize on that kind of relationship?
Well, sure. In his first couple of years, Lyndon Johnson depended on that. President Johnson had been in office in the Senate throughout the 1950s. He was the Senate Majority Leader. And in the early years of what he called the Great Society, those relationships, those negotiating skills were quite important. He also depended on liberals in Congress pushing a lot of his bills in a civil rights movement, but he definitely used the benefits that come with experience to get a legislative agenda through the Hill.
Biden's staff apparently came into the White House studying the legacy of President Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, had an overwhelmingly Democratic Congress behind him, which meant he was able to pass ambitious laws that transformed the country and helped end the Great Depression. Well, what do you think about that? Is FDR a good role model for Biden?
Yeah, as long as he remembers conditions are different. In addition to what you said, the Republican Party has thoroughly radicalized itself, so it's much harder to achieve any negotiation. But what FDR teaches us is when you have presidential power, use it and use it boldly. And that you need a combination of inspiring Americans through rhetoric, but then responding through concrete policies that address the emergency of the day. And those are lessons that transcend time, and I think they would really benefit President Biden as he figures out what to do in the next few weeks.
The other big difference, of course, is that Joe Biden only has 50 Democrats in the Senate. Fast forward to next week, if you could. Some historical notes undoubtedly will be happening when President Trump's second impeachment trial starts. But what will you be watching for?
Well, we'll be watching if there's any kind of break within the Republican Party. We know that Democrats will be pretty clear in terms of what happened was wrong. It was an abuse of power. It was dangerous. Most Republicans will say impeachment is not warranted, or they'll defend what happened. But the only question is, does a significant number of Republicans emerge to vote for conviction? I think it's very unlikely. I think we're going to see in many ways a replay of the first impeachment, and this will be more for the historical record than any concrete action against the former president.
All right. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, thanks as always for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Teachers in Ohio are lining up to get vaccinated against the coronavirus this week. One of the first school systems to get the doses will be in Medina County, just south of Cleveland. We're joined now by Superintendent Robert Halasko. Superintendent, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And this sounds like a pretty big moment for your schools. Tell me about the plan to get your teachers and staff vaccinated on Thursday.
So yeah, a little bit of background here. Part of what got us to being one of the first counties in the state was just the collaboration. We've been meeting weekly with our superintendents and the county health department just to be ready to vaccinate teachers and get the shot in their arm. What we've done is just we're working with Discount Drug Mart now, our vaccination provider for Medina County, and we worked with the governor's office to identify them as having the capacity or the bandwidth to be able to accomplish this on a large scale. We've got about 3,500 eligible educators in Medina County that are going to be receiving the vaccine on Thursday. And one of the things we identified was to be able to get this done in one fell swoop. I mean, there were a number of ways we could have done this, but we decided to have two sites at two of our larger schools. We're going to take the day off of school. At this point, you know, we want to have kids in school, but at the same time, we want to make sure that we can have a safe educational environment. One more day wasn't going to necessarily make or break that, so we felt good about doing that.
Sure.
And that, A, gets our educators back in the classroom as soon as possible, and B, helps Discount Drug Mart and the state allocate anything else to the other counties coming after us. We want to make sure that even though we're first, that that the other schools can get what they need.
Okay, so, I mean, taking a day off of school to do this seems like a legitimate excuse. I'll give you a pass for that. All right. And you're going to try to get it all done in a single day, as you say. It includes everyone, right? Bus drivers, teachers, cafeteria workers, office staff.
Yeah. So the Ohio Department of Health and the Ohio Department of Education defined what an eligible educator was. And everyone you mentioned is pretty much going to be an eligible educator. But for instance, people have said, they've asked me if I'm getting the vaccination. I'm not, because I'm not an eligible educator. I work in the Educational Service Center and don't typically have that much contact with kids in the classroom. So I'm not one of those people that are eligible in this phase, and that's fine. We want to make sure that the people that are working directly with those kids on a day-to-day basis are the ones getting that vaccination.
Mm. All right. Well, many teachers all over the country are either very nervous about the pressure that they feel to get back to in-person learning, or they're already back in the classroom, but they feel unprotected because they haven't yet had the chance to get vaccinated. How important, in your mind, is this step to helping your staff feel safe and getting life back to normal at your schools?
You know, up to this point, our schools have done a really good job, and I know I speak for schools across the nation that, you know, they're doing everything they can with the resources that are allocated to them, and even then some, to make sure those environments are safe as possible. In Medina County, we've been really fortunate that some schools have been in virtual for a short amount of time, but we've been in person as much as we possibly can. And this is really what I say is just another step on that ladder to getting kids back in person, keeping them safe, and looking towards the end of the year, hopefully.
Well, tell me about what it's been like to be in person in your schools. Has it been safe? I mean, what kind of infections have you seen inside the schools that are still in person?
So we've ranged from, we had one small county school that up until I think December, January, didn't even have a documented COVID case. You know, they managed to escape the law of averages on that one. Then we've had other schools where we've had kind of pockets of outbreaks. What we really saw was in the high schools, it seemed to be more prevalent among students or staff, and that's because the high school students are just traveling and engaging more so than maybe an elementary student certainly would be. It's been pockets here and there and has not been astronomical numbers. So I think the schools, in terms of what they're doing to cleaning, to sanitize, to make sure you know they're communicating with parents, our health department's been great in helping us coordinate that. Just if your kid isn't feeling well, the other day we kept my son home. He didn't have COVID, but he wasn't feeling well, had some symptoms, and we kept him home as a precaution.
Yeah. So big day for you and your schools and teachers on Thursday getting this round of vaccines in one fell swoop here for the entire system. But how are you going to handle the second dose? Have you thought about that?
That is kind of one of those things where we want to make sure we're past the first one, but we've already been thinking ahead to that. We don't have any definite plans. One of the things that's been kind of a holdup to that is just the flow of vaccinations from the federal government to the state to the vaccination providers. They've been promised that they're going to get them, but we just want to make sure that when we set that date that we know those vaccines are going to be there on that date. They've got a shelf life, and we want to make sure that none of them are going to waste.
All right. Look, we wish you the best of luck. Superintendent Robert Halasko of the Educational Service Center in Medina County, Ohio, thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thanks, and have a good day.
If you've sung in a choir, you know it's one of the most beautiful feelings of togetherness you can experience. But it's also one of the more dangerous things you can do right now. A group of people in close quarters, breathing and singing together, leads to high risk for COVID-19 infection. So during the pandemic, some singers have had to get creative with ways to continue making music with others. Michelle Pitcher has her own story of why this is so important right now and how it's never been more difficult.
Mitchell Covington is the director of my women's choir in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's also a composer, and when he writes music, he starts with the words. At the beginning of the pandemic, he was leafing through an old book of medieval chants and stumbled across something that struck him.
I found this Alleluia Adorare, and I loved the text, and I loved the musical potential of the text, and I love that word adorare, which means to adore. You know, adore is such a powerful word. That sparked my imagination.
What you're listening to is what became that spark of inspiration. The song is called Alleluia Adorare, and it was created entirely virtually. Each choir member recorded her own voice part from quarantine and sent an audio file to Covington. He then took all these disparate parts and mixed them together using an editing software. Early on in the pandemic, our choir learned that we couldn't get together anymore. So Covington decided to use his song to give us a chance to sing together again, so to speak. It was the first time I'd ever participated in a virtual choir. At no point did I hear other people singing. Most of us didn't really have a grasp of what it would sound like at the end. It was hard. Just ask my fellow choir member, Nikki Reed.
I locked myself in the bedroom, closed all the windows, all the doors, and I set myself up on the bookshelf, and I had my phone with headphones plugged in, listening to the recording.
Alleluia.
It sounded very lonely because it was just my voice, and you couldn't hear the music, obviously, because I had that in headphones, so it didn't mess things up. So it just sounded kind of eerie.
Alleluia, alleluia.
But Nikki also said that when she heard the final version, with everyone's voices blending together, she teared up. It reminded her of what she missed most about singing with a choir.
It's like a mixture of a team sport and an individual sport because, you know, you have to learn the music on your own, but also you really, really have to listen to everybody else. You have to communicate. And I think I just missed that team aspect in creating something really beautiful that other people are interested in.
That really hit me. I grew up doing choir in school. For more than 10 years, I sang almost every day. Then I went to college and thought, I'm free. No more rehearsals or competitions. but after a while, I really felt the lack. My choir director, Mr. Covington, wasn't surprised.
Human beings have been music makers from the very beginning.
He said all faith traditions had chanting because the sung voice carries farther than the spoken voice. So singing just made more sense for group worship.
And once they wrote down their chants, then there were some clever people who had too much time on their hands and said, well, what if we put some other notes, different notes that we sang at the same time?
It reminds me of how beautiful choral music is, even though it's not super popular.
That's Terry Myers, another singer in the choir.
It's a genre that speaks to the soul and the heart for people, and during this time of stress, I think listening to choral music is really healing.
So centuries of religion and musical theory and community led to that strange moment in my apartment when I sang the alto line to a beautiful piece of music into my phone's voice recorder and later listened as Covington brought us all together, at least in song.
Community and isolation are such a big part of this process of the virtual choir, for sure. In a way, it brings us together, but in a way, it accentuates how far apart we are.
It was simultaneously such a strange yet familiar feeling of being vulnerable, of listening, of trusting that the final piece will be worth the effort. For Here and Now, I'm Michelle Pitcher.
Listening to Here and Now. Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, February 9th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
If you've opened Facebook on an Apple device today, maybe you've seen a new pop-up alert touting the benefits of letting the social network collect your personal data. Facebook is trying to get ahead of a new requirement from Apple that could make it easier for users like you and me to stop apps from tracking us across the internet. And that's a problem for Facebook and other tech companies that make most of their money selling ads. Let's bring in Peter Kafka. He's senior correspondent at Recode and host of Recode Media. Hi, Peter.
Hello there.
So first off, what is this change that Apple is making that's prompted this war of pop-ups?
I'm going to try to not get too far into the technical weeds, but Apple has been saying since last spring that they're going to remove something that allows advertisers and other folks to track your behavior on phones. It doesn't say who you are, but it tells developers basically whether you've downloaded an app or engaged in it or an ad. And that's information that Facebook and Google, among others, rely on to make their advertising targeted. So what Apple's essentially doing is making it much harder for Facebook and Google to provide that kind of information to advertisers, which is a problem for them.
I see. And so help users then sort of make a decision if they do encounter this pop-up today. What happens if they click yes versus no?
This is purely messaging right now from Facebook. There's nothing to do. At some point this spring, and this is a moving deadline, it was supposed to happen last fall, and then it was supposed to happen at the beginning of this year, and now Apple says spring. Apple is going to start showing you pop-ups when you use an app like Facebook that says Facebook, or whatever the app is, wants permission to track you over the web. Do you want that? And the expectation from Apple and many other folks is that most people are going to say no. And what Facebook is trying to do is to tell you in advance that you should say yes, and that's a good idea for you to do it.
Well, so, you know, Facebook would say, though, that even though the tracking may sound inherently creepy to some users, that it's actually a convenience for you. It makes the ads more relevant to you. And they will also say that it's good for small businesses that advertise on the platform. So what about those arguments?
The targeted advertising is better for you has long been the argument that people who sell targeted advertising have used for a decade or more. There's some truth to it, and Apple's response to that, by the way, is advertising existed a long time before targeted advertising existed, and you don't need this stuff, and you can live without it. And the small business argument that Facebook is making is saying, look, most of our advertisers are small businesses. That's the bulk of their platform. If you make it harder for them to figure out if their ads are working, you're hurting them. And Apple would respond and say, well, we're really hurting your business and everyone's going to get over it. It's an unusual public fight between these two companies. This stuff usually happens sort of in the background. And the fact that you had Mark Zuckerberg on an earnings call last week announcing that Apple was its competitor and was abusing its platform dominance was very unusual. And then the next day, Tim Cook made a speech that was clearly aimed at Facebook, in which he basically accused it of fomenting social unrest and being bad for society, which, again, is very unusual. You don't usually see two tech CEOs yelling at each other like this in public.
Indeed. And then there's the added dynamic of the possibility of more regulations on Silicon Valley coming out of Washington. So that's something to keep an eye on as well. Peter Kafka is senior correspondent at Recode and the host of Recode Media. Sorry, Peter, to leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Department of Homeland Security has issued its first national terrorism bulletin in more than a year, warning of the potential for more violence following the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. Our next guest warned about the threat of right-wing extremism more than a decade ago, and now he says political violence could get worse unless the government does something about the danger. Daryl Johnson is a former intelligence analyst for the Department of Homeland Security, whose 2009 report on a growing domestic terror threat was criticized by Republicans and veterans groups after it was leaked. Johnson is now head of the security consulting firm DT Analytics. He joins us on a Skype line. Daryl, welcome to Here and Now.
Good morning.
So in 2009, we're feeling the effects of the Great Recession. And in that report at the time, you wrote, the consequences of prolonged economic downturn could create a fertile recruiting environment for right-wing extremists and even result in confrontations between such groups and government authorities similar to those in the past. So, Daryl, what were you seeing at that time that prompted you to issue this warning?
So what we were seeing was, number one, the unprecedented election of the first African-American president, which was basically fulfillment of white supremacist nightmares come true. So with the economic downturn, this also created fertile ground for not only white supremacist groups to flourish, but also because of economic downturn, the anti-government groups would also gain fertile ground for recruitment and radicalization.
And is there some overlap there, Daryl, in the sense that maybe people who would be susceptible to that kind of racist ideology would be triggered even further by experiencing some economic hardship and then, you know, feeling the politics of resentment, perhaps?
Yeah, there is some crossover between white supremacists and anti-government groups. Both of these extremist movements fall on the far right of the political spectrum, but they also have some common grievances. A lot of them believe in conspiracy theories, some of which center on Jewish elites or the 1% controlling the economy as well as the government. And so there's this fear and paranoia that surrounds these types of uncertain times, and people tend to blame all kinds of scapegoats for their problems, whether it be immigrants taking over or jobs going overseas. You know, anti-government groups flourish during these times of uncertainty.
And of course, we're in the middle of another economic downturn now in the midst of a global pandemic. And Daryl, one of the things that made your report in 2009 so polarizing was that you pointed specifically to returning veterans as potentially easy target for right-wing extremists. And in fact, we saw some veterans participating in the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. So what were you seeing that signaled that veterans were vulnerable to radicalization?
We saw extremists targeting veterans back in the early 90s for recruitment and radicalization. And so we predicted that that same pattern would replicate itself today with our returning veterans coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And of course, this is a hard thing for a lot of folks to accept because, of course, our veterans are out there protecting our country. But to the extent that some segment of them can be radicalized, there's a particular danger there, right, Daryl? Because these are people with special and potentially dangerous skill sets.
That's correct. In no way was our report meant to slander veterans. We were just merely pointing to the fact that some veterans could be ripe for recruitment, and they have a unique skill set that could boost the violent capabilities of white supremacists and anti-government groups.
But there was the backlash that we mentioned, and ultimately the DHS secretary at the time, Janet Napolitano, apologized. I'm curious, from your view, what happened in the ensuing years, and how did law enforcement seemingly lose focus on the threat of domestic right-wing terrorism?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that my report was politicized and to the point where the Secretary of Homeland Security at the time had to apologize to the veterans groups. And what happened is, with the political backlash, with the retracting of the report by DHS, it created this chilling effect that basically sent the message, if you talk about these controversial topics and you call attention to these far-right extremist groups, there's going to be hell to pay. And you're going to get FOIA requests, you're going to get citizens calling in, complaining, you're going to get your legislators writing in, and people's jobs are going to be in jeopardy.
That must make your job as an intelligence analyst very hard, though, Daryl, because this is an issue we've seen in other contexts be a big one in recent years. I'm thinking about whether it was, you know, domestic terrorism or let's say foreign interference in our elections. The politicization of intelligence is a very fraught issue in our country right now.
It is, and it goes against the intelligence standards, the tactics and tradecraft that we use that basically say we need to be unbiased and objective in our analysis and just let the facts speak for themselves.
So did you imagine that something like what we saw at the Capitol last month would happen? I mean, is that what you were warning us about? And maybe you weren't surprised.
Well, back in 2009, we were primarily concerned about mass shootings, police ambushes, bombings, arson attacks against faith-based communities. I never envisioned in 2009 that we would have an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. However, given the events of the summer and that we saw two similar events happen in the states of Idaho and Michigan, where their state houses security was breached, it wasn't beyond the realm of possibility. And in fact, I had talked about such a scenario to the media, although it didn't apply to the U.S. Capitol. I was thinking maybe a state capitol would be under siege.
You know, as we were talking about some of the pushback that you received, Daryl, I may as well ask you, since your Republican critics might say, well, listen, you know, left-wing extremism is a thing as well. And I wonder if you see that as an apples-to-apples comparison or whether you see one or the other as clearly the more urgent threat right now.
Yeah, so I think we need to have a balanced approach when we look at the threat landscape, okay? The far left has engaged in property destruction. They've targeted the police. But it hasn't risen to the level of deadly violence that we see from white supremacists and even militia groups plotting to kidnap governors and assassinate political figures. So there is no apples to apples comparison. You've got one group that's got a long history of deadly violence against, you know, civilians as well as government officials and government targets. The other is primarily focused on property destruction.
And then what about how you're weighing foreign terror threats versus domestic terror threats? I think that we have typically thought about these terrorism bulletins from the Department of Homeland Security as focused on foreign terror threats. Is that still number one in your view, or is domestic terrorism surpassing that on the threat scale in your view?
I think we've seen over the past 10 years that the domestic homegrown terrorism has far outweighed the threat from, you know, sympathizers with ISIS and Al-Qaeda here in the homeland. The thing is, when you look at the whole intelligence community and law enforcement community, there's an overwhelming focus on foreign terrorism and those that sympathize and support with those groups here in the United States. But here within, when we talk about white supremacists and anti-government extremists, there's very few analysts and agents working these issues, and there just needs to be a balance in resources. Let the threat dictate the amount of resources and money that go into these programs.
Well, in that vein then, Daryl, I mean, where do we go from here? We have a new administration, and, you know, what we all pay attention to in the headlines are the changes in cabinet-level secretaries, but there's a lot of career folks working behind the scenes who we never see. So does their focal point need to change in the coming years? Or maybe it's staffing up in some way, but what is your prescription for better addressing domestic terrorism in the years to come?
So Biden has already taken a good step in the right direction by calling on the intelligence community to provide a thorough, exhaustive threat assessment on the domestic terrorist threat. That's the beginning of developing strategies, putting in money and resources into the problem. It's getting an idea, just kind of getting your arms around this problem. I also think we need to pass legislation delineating roles and responsibilities among federal agencies, because there's a lot of bureaucratic infighting, jurisdictional turf battles, things like this. And so Dick Durbin's 2021 Terrorism Prevention Act that's been proposed on the Hill is something that I support and I think we should pass.
And it seemed that interagency communication, or perhaps lack thereof, also played a role in the January 6th riot as well. So something to watch for sure. That's Daryl Johnson. He's a former intelligence analyst for the Department of Homeland Security, now the head of DT Analytics, a security consulting firm. Thanks, Daryl.
Thank you.
A judge in Moscow has sentenced Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny to 3.5 years in prison. Navalny was arrested about 2 weeks ago when he returned to Russia from Germany, where he was recovering from a near-fatal poisoning that Navalny says was an assassination attempt by the Russian government. His arrest sparked nationwide protests against the Kremlin. NPR correspondent Lucian Kim is in Moscow, and he joins us now. Lucian, what happened today, and why was Navalny on trial in the first place?
Well, technically, it was not a trial. It was a court hearing. The court ruled in favor of the Russian prison service, which wanted a suspended 3.5 or 3.5 year sentence turned into a real prison sentence. When they subtract a house arrest time that Navalny did, it will probably be about a year less than that. Basically, the prison authority maintained that Navalny had broken the terms of a 2014 conviction and that, therefore, his suspended sentence should be converted into this real prison sentence.
Well, Navalny says there was no way he could fulfill that parole term because he was recovering in Germany from being poisoned, again, as he says, by the Russian government. How did he defend himself in court today?
Well, let's remember that Navalny is a lawyer by training, and he's an extremely effective speaker. He gave a remarkable speech in the courtroom that lasted about 15 minutes. We have a bootleg recording from an independent Russian TV station, since reporters were actually only allowed to take notes. So what he's saying here is that he hopes people won't see this as a signal that they should be afraid of the government, because he said this court proceeding was not a show of strength, but a show of weakness. He very systematically picked apart the prosecution's argument. He said he was being tried in a case that had already been recognized as trumped up by the European Court of Human Rights. Navalny also personally attacked Vladimir Putin. He said the only reason they were recycling this old conviction was because Putin was terribly offended that Navalny hadn't died of the poisoning and dared to come back to Russia. He even mocked Putin as this little thieving person hiding in his bunker, who wasn't at all this great geopolitical thinker, but he spends all his time planning how to kill his opponents with a chemical weapon.
Wow. So going head to head with Vladimir Putin there in a public setting. After nearly dying, Lucien, why did Navalny decide to return to Russia? He must have known he'd be facing legal challenges or worse upon entering the country.
Oh, absolutely. Navalny has never feared arrest. I mean, he has done jail time in the past, you know, 2 weeks at a time for going to unauthorized rallies, that sort of thing. And he actually spent a year under house arrest on that 2014 conviction. Fear doesn't really seem to affect Navalny, and it's this fearlessness that has given him so many followers inside the country. It would have been really surprising if he had decided to stay abroad in Germany and essentially become a political exile, eventually doomed to irrelevance. He knows that his presence in Russia puts enormous pressure on the Kremlin, and he's ready to pay that price.
Well, speaking of pressure, the Biden administration has weighed in on Navalny's detention. Here's the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, speaking last week.
As I say, we have a deep concern for Mr. Navalny's safety and security. And the larger point is that his voice is the voice of many, many, many Russians, and it should be heard, not muzzled.
So what are we hearing from the Kremlin, and what kind of diplomatic repercussions could there be from Navalny's sentence?
Well, right now, I mean, the Kremlin is insisting that this is just a legal procedure and that the authorities are doing their jobs. This is really the standard answer whenever the Kremlin is asked about these kind of political cases. Now, as far as the diplomatic repercussions, this could turn into a disaster for the Kremlin. There are growing calls in Europe to stop the building of the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline, which connects Russia with Germany. And Navalny's own team has come up with a list of Russian businessmen and officials they think should be sanctioned by the West. As we heard, Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, has criticized the Russian government, as has the U.S. ambassador in Moscow. President Putin's spokesman, for his part, says the Kremlin won't take any instructions from the United States.
Well, diplomatic pressure is one thing, but then there is pressure at home. You've been covering the protests that have spread across Russia in the last 2 weeks. Is there a chance that the outcome of this court case could actually have the unintended effect of escalating the situation on the streets and invigorating Navalny's supporters?
Well, we'll just have to see. I mean, the courthouse where he was tried today was on full lockdown, and some 300 people in the vicinity of the courthouse were arrested today. The government is really taking unprecedented measures to stifle dissent. Activists say more than 5,600 people were detained in 90 cities just on Sunday. Here in Moscow, there are reports that there wasn't enough space in city jails and that detainees were forced to sit in crowded buses without food or water. Today, right, the court where the hearing was held was sealed off, and riot police in full battle dress were guarding the perimeter there. So the government is
NPR's,
very nervous about
Lucien,
what
I
got to
cut you off there. I'm so sorry. So sorry. I got to cut you off. NPR's Lucien Kam. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.